Robert H. Mallinckrodt, Distinguished Professor of Chinese Art and Culture at Washington University. Most of those of his students who are here know that he is a very distinguished speaker who has been in demand this year and has given lectures in British Columbia, Washington, Cleveland, and Maryland just in the past 2 months. When Dr. Wu was a young man in China, he embarked on a very, very long walking tour of China with a friend and traveled on foot, overland, and then came back and continued his college education. While he was a college student, he began a novel, Song Never to End, which he finished when he was at Yale. He didn't publish this novel for many, many years, about 20 years, but when it was published, it became an instant bestseller. Dr. Wu is now a best-selling writer in the Chinese language, and we're just publishing some of his first stories to be translated into English in River Styx. In River Styx 7, which is almost sold out, there was a story of Little Boy. And in River Styx 8, we have a story, The Dragon in the Field. Tonight, Dr. Wu is going to tell this story and some other stories. It's a great honor to introduce Dr. Wu.
Thank you very, very much. Let me also express my appreciation for the poetry reading by Jan earlier this evening and the very appropriate and beautiful music that Becky has been playing. And she promised to accompany me whenever the mood moves her. The preparation of this collaboration involves one telephone call yesterday. And I felt that that is probably the best. In many ways, a story creates a space and a continuum of time. And the moment we start a story, we are all in it together. And this is a very symbolic thing with our time today, because a moment ago, Jen mentioned that some of my writings, in fact, several, became bestsellers. That is a reality, and this reality is very frightening because you can become bestseller and become very bad writer. You can be a very good writer and nobody publishes your work, and we are struggling constantly in this kind of an environment, and nothing as good as this, because I'm not just here to praise you. I can't really pick out a dozen people that I really know here. But this is my second time telling a story here. I can already tell you that this is the way perhaps the world civilization will survive, come what it may. It is a kind of a small village. We are here in the village, and in the evening, and we get together, sing some song, read some poetry, exchange some notes, and tell a few stories. It almost takes us out of this reality of a newspaper and television, and then can't even see the stars in the sky because the city lights are too bright. So to set the mood, I know some of you have heard the earlier session when I told story for 3.5 hours early in February. The Dragon in the Field was first time presented in English there. And earlier than that, my story about the so-called cosmic stories, which was here a year ago in May. And then my annual lecture celebrating the winter solstice called The Beginning, the Middle, and the End, the Tao Te, the Makara, and the Chi Wei, which has a lot to do with the story today. So I do think before we get into the reality of the story, in itself, a few words to explain some of the symbolism along the way of the scenery, so that I don't have to jump out of the story to explain things like an aside or so. It would be too dramatic. I just tell it straightforward. Number one, the number 60 is very important to the Chinese civilization. If Kuvarabhyas and others were successfully in predicting 30-some years ago, there is a connection between Chinese civilization and the Mesoamerican civilization. There might be this relationship in Mayan culture, the 52-year cycle, in China, the 60-year cycle. And now we just call a number as a symbolic thing that things come back to its beginning. In my end is my beginning, that kind of a statement. And winter solstice is that kind of a symbol. The sun stood still and makes the whole world worry whether it's going to come back and warm the earth again. And that is because at that time the world discovered agriculture, and solar energy become very important. 60 to the Chinese is you roll, it's like you are rolling two gears. One has 10 teeth and the other one has 12. And if you roll them until they have matched tooth by tooth 60 times, it will go back to the original. That is, if you say from A to J is 10, from 1 to 12, and then A1 and B2, C3, so forth, when you come to 10, 12, it's exactly 60. And the Chinese believe that a lifespan is best measured by 60. When you come to 60, you can call 61 year your newborn year, and 62 your 2-year-old. I'm 2-year-old now. The other thing is about this animal symbolism, the dragon. We talk about the dragon in so many ways. It's a stupid and silly way to approach symbolic animals from zoological classifications. The Western dragon spits fire, the Eastern dragon makes rain, and the Western dragon has wings, the Eastern dragon has a serpentine body, all of that. If you step back and allow more room to look at your symbolism, you realize almost right away what we're looking at is the vocabulary. At that time, we don't have modern terms like antenna, biofeedback. And you have animals. These animals eloquently deliver certain meanings and images. One of the frontal view of the dragon is a famous thing called Tao Tie. If the name sounds strange, I would use only this one term. It is always this monster mask with wide open mouth ready to swallow you, and forever represented without the lower jaw, like this, so that the thing is as big as can be. If you picture the teeth and upper lip on this archway or that archway, and there's no lower jaw, you immediately feel threatened, because that is a new term, interface. It's two realities. The other reality is there, and this one is here. And all these are primordial words and thoughts that we convey them through animal symbolism. And the other things I won't go into. I think you'll find them very familiar. And keep in mind that when I do start a story, we all journey into something very different. I had thought that Jane only wanted me to tell this one story, probably help sell more copies of River Styx. But if you're with me and you know the day is not too long for you, we'll talk about something else. At this moment, I have some vague idea, but I really don't have too many stories to tell. And this one is medium length story. It's called The Dragon in the Field. Dragon in the Field is Again, I'm out of the story now. In I Ching, the Book of the Change. Book of Change is usually written as I and C-H-I-N-G, and therefore sometimes pronounced I Ching, which is transliteration, it should be I Ching. And because I looks like one Ching, and I have a small manuscript, someday I hope to translate, it deals with three lines of the six hexagram of the 64 hexagrams, and I prefer to call it half Qing, one, you know, one half and the Qing. But what I'm now dealing is with one of three of the lines of the first, the foremost of the 64 hexagrams, the Gram of Qian, the dragon, and the male spirit, and the creative force of the universe. So the auspicious beginning, the dragon that's not to be employed, utilized, and then seeing the dragon in the field. All this, if you go back to your Book of Changes, you'll find them in the number one hexagram. Now we begin the story. All my stories are dealing with a time and a space frame of something like pre-industrialization, and the universal vocabulary are villages, houses, farmers, and no manufactured goods. So talk about this man. When he was a little boy, he was very fond of thinking. And that was before schools, before diploma, before credit points, final examinations. And it was a kind of learning for your own sake. And there's no particular reward for what you learn. You have to support yourself by doing something else. Like everybody else, as a villager, he grew up to be a farmer. And his association with his environment is very simple. When he was a little boy, and he would be given a water buffalo to herd, which will carry him here and there. And he is supposed to take care of the water buffalo. But if you look at the in Chinese painting, when the little boy playing the flute, lying on the back of the water buffalo is looking after him. And if you think about Second World War, when China was described as that powerful, huge water buffalo, and yet with a string going through his nostrils, a little boy can take him everywhere he wants him to go. And there was very foreboding even then to say this powerful mass of Chinese energy is capable of following whoever get the buffalo on the tip of the nose. And yet my personal encounter with the water buffalo was a very different one, because there's some integrity about this animal. In this story, I did not really tell them, was that we all travel on the little walkway, rises above the rice paddies, and that usually is made with a spadeful of earth and dried in the sun. It's never wider than a foot or so, just enough for a single person to pass. When two people come in different ways, you have to maneuver yourself around it. But the water buffalo travels on that too. Now, he is perfectly able to travel in water, in the mud, but once in a while, he travels on this walkway, and everybody has to be way out in the mud standing for the water buffalo to go back, because as somebody said, on television commercial, where does the 800-pound gorilla sleep? And the answer is, he sleeps anywhere he wants, things like that. But I didn't quite know about this, and we were working on a wider, a better trail between the rice paddies, and I looked, sighted the water buffalo is coming behind me. There is enough room. If I just do this, he may go by. And this was during an air raid, and we're all in the countryside, everybody fending for himself. I didn't quite want to go to the mud of the rice paddy. And so I was really doing something like this, and here's a water buffalo moving slowly past me. I cleared the biggest part of his belly. He's very large. I did not see that his hip was about there. Without even sensing it, I was off something like 6 feet, you know. Here I go. And this is a kind of a picture that is about all you need to transport ourselves from Duff's to that kind of a country place. And there was this little boy. He learned how to herd the buffalo. And either he is leading the buffalo or the buffalo leading to him. And there are images of him and falling asleep on the back of his water buffalo, who was seeking the shade and was stopping outside of the village school. And when the village school teacher was lecturing his best and his own student falling asleep, and then this sleepy little boy on the water buffalo may absorb the wisdom from that teacher. All these things we cannot ascertain, and no one is really in the mood to prove anything tonight. But here was this boy, he grew up and wanting nothing better than to become a philosopher, a learned man. And then as he grew up, he indeed became a very learned man. In the eyes of the villagers, he must have been very learned, because there are, from time to time, these travelers from faraway places would ask about him by name, and when they saw him, when they would produce from their knapsack the very well-wrapped manuscripts, and they would open that up and would discuss their scholarly work. And this happens again and again, and of course the villagers and his own family would get close to him and listen to what they talk about, and nobody could understand them, but knew they must be very serious. So immediately they felt among themselves, there's somebody must be terribly important, and these other people are important too, but there seemed to me that their own scholar is more important, because he never go out anywhere to ask other people's advices and criticism, but other people keep coming to him. Then he was basically a farmer. When they talk very long hours, sometimes stay at his place for 2 or 3 days, he would say, well, there's work to do, I have to be at the farm. And these scholars will follow him to the farm, talking all the way. And at the end of the day, he has to come home, and they will talk all the way back to home again. And this becomes the pattern in a few years, and they do not think it's anything unusual. But gradually, the things begin to change a little. He will speak very little, and while the other scholars who came over seem just to empty themselves to him, and he, instead of making any comments and giving any advices, he asked questions, and the questions were usually not answered. Some of them begin to have doubts, saying that he must be worrying about something else, something different than we consider as scholarship. And indeed he was. Scholarship to him was a means to an end. He wanted to know things about life. And the avenue to approach that was scholarship. And scholarship itself was not all that important. And some of the scholars would go away shaking their hand and said, well, we thought we had problems coming here to ask him questions. He has bigger problems than we have. And then the poor villagers said, if these people all have problems, and then ours having the worst problems, and who are we to tell him what to do, say they leave him alone. And he gradually become more and more crazy. And he would begin to ignore his fellow villagers and people when he was in that mood. They will see him running down the one only village street, as if seeing something. And when the other people tried to catch his attention, he couldn't even see them. And he must be seeing something, because sometimes that something he's seeing seemed to be very ferocious. And he would dodge. And then he seemed to be hiding here and there to from that invisible monster. And yet he could not quite keep himself away from it. He would hide behind something and still looking out, trying to get a close examination of this object. They can tell when this happens because his eyeballs will be rolling all over the place. And they said, this poor man is getting farther, farther out. And yet they felt very helpless to help him. In one particular day, actually, he dodged behind his gate. And there was this, in front of his courtyard, these big wooden doors. And he stood behind the gate and looked out behind the door and the wooden door jamb. Looking out for a long time. And then he would come out. And again, nobody saw anything. The worst was that when he became about 60 years old. And this day, he seemed to be very calm, and nobody anticipated anything that was going to happen. He went out to his field to do a little weeding. It's a fine spring day, and there was nothing in this broad daylight that looked anything unusual. So there's a few other farmers also working there, but he saw something. He must have. And he ignored everybody. He went up to a little high point on the road, and he gazed to the horizon. And he stood there for a long time. Never before had they seen him as excited as this time. They were sure that this time he's a goner. He's not going to come back. And then he stood there. And he bent down and picked up a pebble and threw it in front of himself. And he watched a little while later. And then he took off one of his slippers and he threw that one in front of himself. And then he threw the other one in. And that wasn't the end of that. And then he gingerly put one foot forward, and then he touched this area in front of him, and then he shifted his weight to that foot, and with the other foot hung up in the air. And that way he stood a long time. Then he put the other foot down where the first one was, found his slippers, put them on, took a long walk and went home. The story actually ended here. But from, it did. And from what he was, it was a little different. When he was a little boy, he decided there's something in learning he must have. And he learned. There's no reward, there's no particular reason to for him to do that. And he found that was his avenue to the meaning of life. And he first, in his first stage, is by learning all the wisdom in the classics. And he really felt he was learned because he could really differentiate the nuances of one philosopher from another, one writing from another. When the scholars in this field came to talk to him, he can point out where they made the wrong turn, where they made the wrong interpretation, and his reputation spread, and more people came asking him to criticize their manuscript. When he was in his middle age, he began to go beyond everything he had learned, and he's beginning to nourish, instead of answers, questions. And the greatest treasure he had was doubt. And the doubt sometimes hit him so powerfully as if it was a tidal wave hitting the shore and breaking the sea into shimmering lights that looked like the scale of a sea monster. And he gets that kind of excitement, and he knew that even if he should be killed by these attacks of doubt, doubt is what he wanted, and all the answers that he was able to give when he was a famous young scholar was nothing to compare with this. And this is the time he could not help his visiting scholars, and they thought he's having worse problem than they had. When he had doubts, he occasionally in the beginning would shift back his position to the moment of reassurance, where he had made good as a well-known scholar, where he at least have a few security to go back to. when he was really a good swimmer in the sea of doubt, he enjoyed the doubt itself, and all the realities and the firm solutions and answers were become unfirm and shifting and illusionary again. And so this was at this time he began to hear from somewhere inside his head a voice saying that in most of the time, now this is very difficult to paraphrase, if you hear a voice from your head, it does not come through in any one particular language or any